It is time to bring in David Tarachuk. It's time for the Media Beat. David joins us here live on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast David on the weekend and also after the Monday noon news. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, has his own great website called themediabeat.us, and we're always pleased to have him join us on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hello to you. Coming into you this week, as for so many weeks now that I'm back in the country, from the media capital of the world, New York City.
And there's a lot we can tap on this morning. First of all, the ruling, a new state law in Georgia, which just so blatantly shows a suppression of the vote. We'll start off with that.
It's one of probably hundreds, at least 200 pieces of state legislation that are being brought forward now to change the way that we conduct elections. And of course, these are all within the authority of individual states. Georgia has been the first because I suspect Georgia was the most disturbing overturn. The victory of two Democratic senators and the consequent change of power of control in the U.S. Senate as a result. So inevitably, Republicans up and down the country, but Georgia to the fore here, of course, naturally because of the pressing need that they sense, that they need to get a better grip on the way that they can and often do control the number of people who get to vote in their states. It's as cynical a ploy as that. As you say, it's blatant, very blatant indeed. Some of the detail of the measures are kind of jaw-dropping. It's now an offense in Georgia, for instance, to bring food or drink to someone who's in line to vote at a polling station. Now, there are reasons for that, ostensibly, people could possibly be bribed to turn up to vote, bribed by the idea of getting some food, bribed by the prospect of a drink. But, of course, in reality, what we know is that, people will do a little bit of enticing sometimes when you're trying to do a vigorous get-out-to-vote push. But in Georgia, if you stand on line for a long time in conditions, and even in November, voting day in Georgia, then you're likely to get a little parched, a little thirsty. So the idea of drink, being given a drink, is hardly a huge inducement. It's more just a salve for your dedication. There are bits and pieces of all this legislation which kind of peek through and show very clearly the cynical desire on Republican legislators throughout many states to limit the numbers of people who get to vote in the first place, because it's pretty clear now, it's accepted, and Republicans openly acknowledge this, that the higher the turnout, the more it favors Democrats rather than Republicans.
Pretty simple equation there. And on the flip side, Joe Biden gave his first presidential news conference yesterday. I did watch it, and I watched it with the following caveats. The press was not easy on him. I think the press did ask legitimate questions over and over and over again. B, I think the way he answered the questions was the way that a traditional president does answer the questions, letting some information out, holding some back, not. And C, the acrimony between the president and the press, of course, has disappeared, and it makes the whole process, once again, I think it helps legitimize the presidential position in this country.
Yeah, it was a big deal for the journalism world to see presidential press conference take place without all the rambunctiousness and the sense of it being a circus show that we'd kind of gotten used to over the previous 4 years. And right from the get-go, it was clear it was going to be different, if only because of the restrictions enforced by COVID or occasioned by COVID. It was in the East Room, not in the in the broad, spacious East Room, not the tight huddle of a press briefing room, as traditionally is the case, has been the case. And in the East Room, journalists were spaced out considerably, enormous gaps between them, and plenty of room in this particular context, this particular set of circumstances, for press people to run in between the journalists and kneel down in between them and take their photographs. It was rather bizarre to someone who's used to a very different and much tighter and much more populated gathering. But yes, the conduct of the press conference, which was probably the more important thing, was that of a pretty full to and fro between someone who's got the goodies, got the goods, and those of us who are seeking information about the goods. And you're right, Biden was kind of very forthcoming. I mean, often throughout his life he's been very forthcoming. He tends to talk in rather long answers. In fact, he found himself apologizing for that a couple of times yesterday, and indeed stopping himself at a couple of points too, saying, I better not go on. And at the same time, the journalists, for their part, were, well, for a start, they weren't shouting their questions, trying to, be heard over the tumult. It was very polite, I guess, rather orderly. And, of course, the president was picking on individual questioners, as is always the case, for whatever the circumstances. But you had a sense that he knew directly who he was talking to and had a bit of a, not exactly intimate, but, personal interaction between himself and each journalist whenever he could, which, of course, is just an ordinary, common, decent thing to do if you're a leader who's in the company of journalists who are, in fact, your communication line to the public, and it's at least a more human form of line of communication to the public than, say, a Twitter stream, which is what the former president came to rely upon. In the end, really ditching the press briefing room type of press conference in favor of these snatched opportunities as he walked out towards Marine One, the presidential helicopter.
As a person who has asked questions of leaders, political leaders, and political people in general around the world, when you look at now the way the press is handling a very important topic, which is whether the Democrats will go forward with getting rid of the filibuster rule or not, what is your take on that?
Well, pressing the question, and of course, the question isn't going to be graced with an answer. The politicians in charge of this whole matter, and the president, remember, isn't the only decider in this case, although he's obviously going to be influential on whether the Democrats decide to make a push for getting rid of the filibuster in order to get legislation through the Senate at on a simple majority instead of the three-fifths of the 60 seats, in other words, in the Senate, which is essentially what the filibuster means. That's what its vote counting consequence is. So we are very often, certainly for now, journalists may press the question insistently, but they're not going to get an answer. And of course, any sensible journalist knows that. But it's also no reason not to answer, not to keep asking the question. You never know; someone might reveal what the strategy is, and that's what people were hoping for yesterday. And we didn't get that, though we got some hints. Biden made it pretty clear that he believes the use of the filibuster has been what he called an abuse. So clearly he doesn't favor it, not the way that it's been put to use in the Senate in recent times. And, you know, one of the many little cheat cards that he had to hand gave some figures, which are somewhat exaggerated. He said that the number of times that the filibuster has been resorted to over the last few years, essentially during the previous 4 years, plus a bit, is five times what it was over a whole period from 1917, when the idea of the two-thirds, the previous two-thirds of the vote that was needed to get something debate closed and something voted on, and in 1975 when the law changed again. So, you know, he was making a point. He prepared for it. He even had it on a little card. I say he actually admitted. He said, "I'm just looking for the card right now for the details." And he was full of details yesterday. So it makes sense for journalists to keep pressing the question, even though, as I say, they're not likely to get an answer right now. But clearly, that's the job. That's what the job entails, and we will get an answer before too long.
You know, and as I look at international news, I said all along that the return of normalcy, and I'm not talking about agendas or anything, but of the President of the United States and the United States re-entering and entering again with their allies and with the rest of the world, I think it has made a difference in a story that I've been following, and that is China. They have, of course, come out very strongly against the UK MPs after sanctions were put on for abuse of Muslims. And I think that the UK and Europe in general needed the United States to come out of its shell to press this, because China is a very, very strong economic opponent.
Yeah, the British, for instance, were in a sense the first to do something, in a kind of nitty-gritty, specific, individually targeted bit of sanctioning in the last couple of days, sanctioning individual Chinese, prominent Chinese individuals in the party and in the government apparatus. And there it's the United States will do so in fuller form too. Yes, and of course, you know, the other side of that new engagement that you describe is that in Alaska, United States officials and Chinese officials were actually talking to each other in pretty damn strong language over this past week. Nothing has emerged from it in terms of any kind of agreement. They wouldn't expect that yet. But something is happening in a different form now. On the American side, something extremely different. I mean, getting engaged fully in what you described as a combination of allies, that hasn't been done over the last 4 years either. But in this case, the United States is combining forces in what's called the Quad. You and I have talked about this before. India, Japan, and Australia, as well as the United States, the four nations who believe themselves to be in the forefront of handling China's aggressive stance towards the rest of the world economically, and in some cases in the region itself, and this affects Japan most of all, in a threatening military posture too. So yes, things are changing, and one suspects. I mean, who knows what the overall outcome will be? One suspects that you may find China responding in a way that they didn't feel they needed to in the Trump years.
And looking also at the EU, this story I think is misunderstood by a lot of Americans. I'm going to say a lot. The Americans that casually look at their own news channels and their own sources of news, and that has been the row over the past couple of weeks about the EU, basically saying they might ban export of the coronavirus vaccination, but they've stopped short of that. That is a pretty big story in itself.
Sure, and the whole background of that story, which is in essence that the EU has made a very big mistake, and it's trying its best to recover. What it's found is that it didn't get itself into a vaccine rollout anywhere near effectively as the United States, or in their own terms, as they review it themselves in their regional context, not as well as the Brits, who just left the EU, managed to achieve. Of course, that's a rather resonant and sore point politically between Europe and Britain. And here's an opportunity for me to celebrate a good an extraordinary piece of journalism. I'd like to hear the fanfare, if you have it to hand, for a surprising choice of mine.
Well, yeah, let me get it up here. Let me bring it up. I gotta find it here very quickly.
It's for a source that I don't normally single out for praise. I mean, you might find it a little odd for me to be praising, of all people, The Sun, what is for the most popular tabloid newspaper in Britain. Traditionally called itself the Soar Away Sun, meaning, of course, that its circulation figures soar away. Well, they're not soaring as much as they used to. There it is.
There we go.
Yeah, the fanfare is for The Sun, a Murdoch-owned newspaper. It may surprise people who know my attitude towards the Murdoch empire to find me praising it. But the paper that's been known for photographs of topless women for so long that we got, as journalists in Britain, we used to have what we would call every morning when the paper appeared, what we would call the Sun nipple count. all the topless females graced not just the main topless portrait that was always on page three, hence the creation of a phenomenon called the Sun page three girl, but it was the nipples were sprinkled liberally throughout the paper for a long time, and this only came to an end 4 years ago. It's extraordinary to think that such a antiquated attitude to women should prevail in a highly popular newspaper for so long as it did. But anyway, the present day Sun, it's also a journalistic organization. They have news reporters, and in this particular case, a deputy political editor called Kate Ferguson, who got a Sun exclusive, and the Sun exclusive was a recording. Easily got in these days of Zoom, I'm afraid. I think it's all too obvious how the Sun got this, but it was a supposedly closed meeting of Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his own political party, Conservative Members of Parliament, in which he said some classic words, which in it became the Sun exclusive, talking about the vaccine success that Britain has had, certainly compared with Europe. And I'm going to quote him exactly here. He said, "Gentlemen, the reason we have the vaccine success is because of capitalism, because of greed, my friends." So, with a little nod to Gordon Gekko and the movie Wall Street, he said, "Oh, I guess many people believe this to be the classic gaffe when you say something true by mistake." And he very rapidly tried to walk it back, of course, even before it was publicized. Even during the event, he realized that he'd misstepped, and he found himself saying, "Forget I said that, and actually I do regret saying it now." But there it was, in the open, because of diligent work, quite easy work, I suspect. But the Sun, although it makes its job most of the time because Murdoch requires it to, is very supportive of the Conservatives in Britain. In this particular case, the fact that they had a juicy story meant that they had to blast that over the front page, and rightly so, of course. We need to know what our leaders are talking to their own supporters, their own foot soldiers in this particular case, members of parliament, when they think they're not being overheard by the public, and it was indeed very revealing. And it feeds into what you described there as something of a, not exactly a war, but certainly a great deal of acrimony between Europe and Britain about the state of the vaccine rollout, or whatever the plural rollout is, when you compare Britain with the EU. And the truth of the matter, of course, is the and it's a kind of an irony that the poorer performance by the EU compared with the UK and with the United States, for that matter, has been caused by them having relied on the market in sort of almost American-style devotion to market forces, in the sense that they were behaving like the countries of the EU were behaving like customers, hoping for a good deal out of big pharma companies as their suppliers, rather than taking any strong governmental intervention themselves, like indeed the United States, even under Trump, and the Warp Speed program that was adopted there, which is essentially a decision to use enormous amounts of tax dollars to energize the pharma companies, big pharma companies, and do a kind of public-private partnership, but with one that simply couldn't have been done without government pressure and without government money. A wholly different picture, and almost the reverse of what you expect when you compare Europe with America.
I just want to go one more news story here, and I had a feeling this was coming the other day when Sidney Powell, we all know who Sidney Powell is, the lawyer for Donald Trump, in a courtroom basically said, well, anybody that heard what I said had to understand that it was, basically she said people had to understand that what she was saying was patently untrue and a lie. And this morning, about 7 minutes ago, Dominion Voting Systems has filed a $1.6 billion lawsuit against Fox News. And I'd be willing to bet you that by Sidney Powell admitting that in the open just the other day, really moved this lawsuit by Dominion ahead.
Sure. It's all of a piece with a certain style of defending Trump and Trumpism that developed over those nightmare 4 years that we've just come out of. I'm paraphrasing fully here, but the argument goes along the lines of, well, you know, Trump and the Trumpers don't really mean that. You're not meant to take them seriously in the sense of ever taking them literally. And of course, you know, it's a great get-out clause for the Trumpists who are quite often were and still are, of course, knowingly uttering falsehoods. And there's a kind of coded communication going on. You know, they're essentially saying to their own audience, their own base, you know, this isn't true, but this is what we're saying because this is the line which gets us most attention and gets us further forward. For Sidney Powell to admit what she admitted is no more than what I think most sensible people realize. But having it on record, sure, is going to help the legal case, which is all about the manufacturing and the amplification of a big lie that there was fraudulent activity that robbed the Trump Republican Party of victory in 2020.
All right, and I just want to wrap up with a story about the Suez Canal. Canals always have amazed me. The Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, they're amazing feats of engineering that really keep the economy around the world going. And the size of that cargo ship, which was blown off course in the canal and wound up blocking the canal and costing probably billions of dollars of losses each day, is a story that's in itself is amazing.
It's jaw-dropping. It's almost comical if it weren't for the serious impact that it's clearly going to have on world trade. But yes, canals are amazing things. I made a documentary while using a kind of position of access that I had because of the UN, the United Nations, where I was based at the time, and seeing how those canals were built and the making of the locks and the operation nowadays of the locks is extraordinary. And the Suez, of course, revolutionized world trade by cutting out that enormous trip around the bulk of the African continent to get to the Far East. So, yeah, it's an extraordinarily big story in every sense, and I think it's been covered rather effectively. We now, of course, have got all the drones in the world that we need to cover that story very fully visually, and it is, of course, as well as everything else, a very strong visual story that works very well on the screen.
Well, it's always interesting and great to rehash these subjects. We'll see what happens in the next week, David.
Talk to you next week.
Take care. That is David Tarachuk with The Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. And you can listen to David. All of his shows are online, robinhoodradio.com. Click on Demand. Click on Media Beat with David Tarachuk.